Side 3. The City and the Stars and the Sands of Mars by Arthur C. Clarke. Continuing with The City and the Stars on page 85. They stepped through it, took a few paces along the short corridor beyond, and then were standing in a great circular cavern whose walls came together in a sweeping curve 300 feet above their heads. The column down whose interior they had descended seemed far too slim to support the millions of tons of rock above it. Indeed, it did not seem to be an integral part of the chamber at all, but gave the impression of being an afterthought. Kedron, following Alvin's gaze, arrived at the same conclusion. "This column," he said, speaking rather jerkily as if anxious to find something to say, "was built simply to house the shaft down which we came. It could never have carried the traffic that must have passed through here when Diaspora was still open to the world. That came through those tunnels over there. I suppose you recognize what they are." Alvin looked toward the walls of the chamber, more than 100 yards away. Piercing them at regular intervals were large tunnels, 12 of them, radiating in all directions exactly as the moving ways still did today. He could see that they sloped gently upward, and now he recognized the familiar grey surface of the moving ways. These were only the severed stumps of the great roads. The strange material that gave them life was now frozen into immobility. When the park had been built, the hub of the moving way system had been buried, but it had never been destroyed. Alvin began to walk toward the nearest of the tunnels. He had gone only a few paces when he realized that something was happening to the ground beneath his feet. It was becoming transparent. A few more yards, and he seemed to be standing in mid-air without visible support. He stopped and stared down into the void beneath him. "Kedron!" he called. "Come and look at this!" The other joined him, and together they gazed at the marvel beneath their feet. Faintly visible, at an indefinite depth, lay an enormous map, a great network of lines converging toward a spot beneath the central shaft. They stared at it in silence for a moment. Then Kedron said quietly, "You realize what this is?"
"I think so," replied Alvin.
"It's a map of the entire transport system, and those little circles must be the other cities of Earth. I can just see names beside them, but they're too faint to read."
"There must have been some form of internal illumination once," said Kedron absently.
He was tracing the lines beneath his feet, following them with his eyes out toward the walls of the chamber.
"I thought so," he exclaimed suddenly. "Do you see how all these radiating lines lead toward the small tunnels?"
Alvin had noticed that besides the great arches of the moving ways, there were innumerable smaller tunnels leading out of the chamber. Tunnels that sloped downward instead of up. Kedron continued without waiting for a reply.
"It would be hard to think of a simpler system. People would come down the moving ways, select the place they wished to visit, and then follow the appropriate line on the map."
"And what happened to them after that?" asked Alvin.
Kedron was silent, his eyes searching out the mystery of those descending tunnels. There were 30 or 40 of them, all looking exactly the same. Only the names on the map would have enabled one to distinguish between them, and those names were indecipherable now. Alvin had wandered away and was circumnavigating the central pillar. Presently his voice came to Kedron, slightly muffled and overlaid with echoes from the walls of the chamber.
"What is it?"
called Kedron, not wishing to move, because he had nearly succeeded in reading one of the dimly visible groups of characters. But Alvin's voice was insistent, so he went to join him. Far beneath was the other half of the great map, its faint webwork radiating to the points of the compass. This time, however, not all of it was too dim to be clearly seen, for one of the lines, and only one, was brilliantly illuminated. It seemed to have no connection with the rest of the system, and pointed like a gleaming arrow to one of the downward-sloping tunnels. Near its end, the line transfixed a circle of golden light, and against that circle was the single word, Lys. That was all. For a long time, Alvin and Kedron stood gazing down at that silent symbol. To Kedron, it was a challenge he knew he could never accept, and which, indeed, he would rather did not exist. But to Alvin, it hinted at the fulfillment of all his dreams. Though the word Lys meant nothing to him, he let it roll around his mouth, tasting its sibilance like some exotic flavor. The blood was pounding in his veins, and his cheeks were flushed as by a fever. He stared around this great concourse, trying to imagine it as it had been in the ancient days, when air transport had come to an end, but the cities of Earth still had contact with one another. He thought of the countless millions of years that had passed with the traffic steadily dwindling and the lights on the great map dying one by one, until at last only this single line remained. How long, he wondered, had it gleamed there among its darkened companions, waiting to guide the steps that never came, until Jarl and Zay had sealed the moving ways and closed Diaspora against the world. And that had been a billion years ago. Even then, Lys must have lost touch with Diaspora. It seemed impossible that it could have survived. Perhaps, after all, the map meant nothing now. Kedron broke into his reverie at last. He seemed nervous and ill at ease, not at all like the confident and self-assured person that he had always been in the city above. "I do not think that we should go any farther now," he said. "It may not be safe until we are more prepared." There was wisdom in this, but Alvin recognized the underlying note of fear in Kedron's voice. Had it not been for that, he might have been sensible. But a too acute awareness of his own valor, combined with a contempt for Kedron's timidity, drove Alvin onward. It seemed foolish to have come so far, only to turn back when the goal might be in sight. "I'm going down that tunnel," he said stubbornly, as if challenging Kedron to stop him. "I want to see where it leads." He set off resolutely, and after a moment's hesitation, the jester followed him along the arrow of light that burned beneath their feet. As they stepped into the tunnel, they felt the familiar tug of the peristaltic field, and in a moment were being swept effortlessly into the depths. The journey lasted scarcely a minute. When the field released them, they were standing at one end of a long, narrow chamber in the form of a half-cylinder. At its distant end, two dimly lit tunnels stretched away toward infinity. Men of almost every civilization that had existed since the dawn would have found their surroundings completely familiar. Yet to Alvin and Kedron, this was a glimpse of another world. The purpose of the long, streamlined machine that lay aimed like a projectile at the far tunnel was obvious, but that made it nonetheless novel. Its upper portion was transparent, and looking through the walls, Alvin could see rows of luxuriously appointed seats. There was no sign of any entrance, and the entire machine was floating about a foot above a single metal rod that stretched away into the distance, disappearing in one of the tunnels. A few yards away, another rod led to the second tunnel, but no machine floated above it. Alvin knew as surely as if he had been told that somewhere beneath unknown far-off Lys, that second machine was waiting in another such chamber as this. Kedron began to talk, a little too swiftly. "What a peculiar transport system! It could only handle 100 people at a time, so they could not have expected much traffic. And why did they go to all this trouble to bury themselves in the earth if the skies were still open? Perhaps the invaders would not even permit them to fly, though I find that hard to believe. Or was this built during the transition period, while men still travelled but did not wish to be reminded of space? They could go from city to city and never see the sky and the stars." He gave a nervous laugh. "I feel sure of one thing, Alvin. When this existed, it was much like Diaspora. All cities must be essentially the same. No wonder that they were all abandoned in the end and merged into Diaspora. What was the point of having more than one?" Alvin scarcely heard him. He was busy examining the long projectile, trying to find the entrance. If the machine was controlled by some central or verbal code order, he might never be able to make it obey him, and it would remain a maddening enigma for the rest of his life. The silently opening door took him completely unawares. There was no sound, no warning, when a section of the wall simply faded from sight, and the beautifully designed interior lay open before his eyes. This was the moment of choice. Until this instant, he had always been able to turn back if he wished. But if he stepped inside that welcoming door, he knew what would happen, though not where it would lead. He would no longer be in control of his own destiny, but would have placed himself in the keeping of unknown forces. He scarcely hesitated. He was afraid to hold back, being fearful that if he waited too long, this moment might never come again, or that if it did, his courage might not match his desire for knowledge. Kedron opened his mouth in anxious protest, but before he could speak, Alvin had stepped through the entrance. He turned to face Kedron, who was standing framed in the barely visible rectangle of the doorway, and for a moment there was a strange silence while each waited for the other to speak. The decision was made for them. There was a faint flicker of translucence, and the wall of the machine had closed again. Even as Alvin raised his hand in farewell, the long cylinder started to ease itself forward. Before it had entered the tunnel, it was already moving faster than a man could run. There had been a time when every day millions of men made such journeys, in machines basically the same as this, as they shuttled between their homes and their humdrum jobs. Since that far-off day, man had explored the universe and returned again to Earth, had won an empire and had it wrestled from his grasp. Now such a journey was being made again, in a machine wherein legions of forgotten and unadventurous men would have felt completely at home. And it was to be the most momentous journey any human being had undertaken for a billion years. Alistra had searched the tomb a dozen times, though once was quite sufficient, for there was nowhere anyone could hide. After the first shock of surprise, she had wondered if what she had followed across the park had not been Alvin and Kedron at all, but only their projections. But that made no sense. Projections were materialized at any spot one wished to visit, without the trouble of going there in person. No sane person would walk his projected image a couple of miles, taking half an hour to reach his destination when he could be there instantly. No, it was the real Alvin and the real Kedron that she had followed into the tomb. Somewhere, then, there must be a secret entrance. She might as well look for it while she was waiting for them to come back. As luck would have it, she missed Kedron's reappearance, for she was examining a column behind the statue when he emerged on the other side of it. She heard his footsteps, turned toward him, and saw at once that he was alone.
"Where is Alvin?"
she cried. It was some time before the jester answered. He looked distraught and irresolute, and Alistra had to repeat her question before he took any notice of her. He did not seem in the least surprised to find her there. "I do not know where he is," he answered at last. "I can only tell you that he is on his way to Lys. Now you know as much as I do." It was never wise to take Kedron's words at their face value, but Alistra needed no further assurance that the jester was not playing his role today. He was telling her the truth, whatever it might mean. Chapter 10. When the door closed behind him, Alvin slumped into the nearest seat. All strength seemed suddenly to have been drained from his legs. At last he knew, as he had never known before, that fear of the unknown that haunted all his fellow men. He felt himself trembling in every limb, and his sight became misty and uncertain. Could he have escaped from this speeding machine, he would willingly have done so, even at the price of abandoning all his dreams. It was not fear alone that overwhelmed him, but a sense of unutterable loneliness. All that he knew and loved was in Diaspora. Even if he was going into no danger, he might never see his world again. He knew, as no man had known for ages, what it meant to leave one's home forever. In this moment of desolation, it seemed to him of no importance whether the path he was following led to peril or to safety. All that mattered to him now was that it led away from home. The mood slowly passed. The dark shadows lifted from his mind. He began to pay attention to his surroundings and to see what he could learn from the unbelievably ancient vehicle in which he was travelling. It did not strike Alvin as particularly strange or marvellous that this buried transport system should still function perfectly after such eons of time. It was not preserved in the eternity circuits of the city's own monitors, but there must be similar circuits elsewhere guarding it from change or decay. For the first time, he noticed the indicator board that formed part of the forward wall. It carried a brief but reassuring message. Liss, 35 minutes. Even as he watched, the number changed to 34. That, at least, was useful information, though since he had no idea of the machine's speed, it told him nothing about the length of the journey. The walls of the tunnel were one continual blur of grey, and the only sensation of movement was a very slight vibration he would never have noticed had he not looked for it. Diaspora must be many miles away by now, and above him would be the desert with its shifting sand dunes. Perhaps at this very moment he was racing below the broken hills he had watched so often from the Tower of Loran. His imagination sped onward to Liss, as if impatient to arrive ahead of his body. What sort of a city would it be? No matter how hard he tried, he could only picture another and smaller version of Diaspora. He wondered if it still existed, then assured himself that not otherwise would this machine be carrying him swiftly through the earth. Suddenly there was a distinct change in the vibration underfoot. The vehicle was slowing down. There was no question of that. The time must have passed more swiftly than he had thought. Somewhat surprised, Alvin glanced at the indicator. Liss, 23 minutes. Feeling puzzled and a little worried, he pressed his face against the side of the machine. His speed was still blurring the walls of the tunnel into a featureless grey, yet now, from time to time, he could catch a glimpse of markings that disappeared almost as quickly as they came. And at each disappearance, they seemed to remain in his field of vision for a little longer. Then, without any warning, the walls of the tunnel were snatched away on either side. The machine was passing, still at a very great speed, through an enormous empty space, far larger even than the chamber of the moving ways. Peering in wonder through the transparent walls, Alvin could glimpse beneath him an intricate network of guiding rods, rods that crossed and crisscrossed to disappear into a maze of tunnels on either side. A flood of bluish light poured down from the arched dome of the ceiling, and silhouetted against the glare, he could just make out the frameworks of great machines. The light was so brilliant that it pained the eyes, and Alvin knew that this place had not been intended for man. A moment later, his vehicle flashed past row after row of cylinders, lying motionless above their guide rails. They were much larger than the one in which he was travelling, and Alvin guessed that they must have been used for transporting freight. Around them were grouped incomprehensible many-jointed mechanisms, all silent and stilled. Almost as quickly as it had appeared, the vast and lonely chamber vanished behind him. Its passing left a feeling of awe in Alvin's mind. For the first time, he really understood the meaning of that great darkened map below Diaspora. The world was more full of wonder than he had ever dreamed. Alvin glanced again at the indicator. It had not changed. He had taken less than a minute to flash through the great cavern. The machine was accelerating again, though there was little sense of motion. The tunnel walls were flowing past on either side at a speed he could not even guess. It seemed an age before that indefinable change of vibration occurred again. Now the indicator was reading, Liss, 1 minute. That minute was the longest that Alvin had ever known. More and more slowly moved the machine. This was no mere slackening of its speed. It was coming at last to rest. Smoothly and silently, the long cylinder slid out of the tunnel into a cavern that might have been the twin of the one below Diaspora. For a moment, Alvin was too excited to see anything clearly. The door had been open for a considerable time before he realized that he could leave the vehicle. As he hurried out of the machine, he caught a last glimpse of the indicator. Its wording had now changed, and its message was infinitely reassuring. Diaspora, 35 minutes. As he began to search for a way out of the chamber, Alvin found the first hint that he might be in a civilization different from his own. The way to the surface clearly lay through a low, wide tunnel at one end of the cavern, and leading up through the tunnel was a flight of steps. Such a thing was extremely rare in Diaspora. The architects of the city had built ramps or sloping corridors whenever there was a change of level. This was a survival from the days when most robots had moved on wheels and so found steps an impassable barrier. The stairway was very short and ended against doors that opened automatically at Alvin's approach. He walked into a small room, like that which had carried him down the shaft under the tomb of Yarlan Zay, and was not surprised when a few minutes later the doors opened again to reveal a vaulted corridor rising slowly to an archway that framed a semicircle of sky. There had been no sensation of movement, but Alvin knew that he must have risen many hundreds of feet. He hurried forward up the slope to the sunlit opening, all fear forgotten in his eagerness to see what lay before him. He was standing at the brow of a low hill, and for an instant it seemed as if he were once again in the central park of Diaspora. Yet if this were indeed a park, it was too enormous for his mind to grasp. The city he had expected to see was nowhere visible. As far as the eye could reach, there was nothing but forest and grass-covered plains. Then Alvin lifted his eyes to the horizon, and there, above the trees, sweeping from right to left in a great arc that encircled the world, was a line of stone which would have dwarfed the mightiest giants of Diaspora. It was so far away that its details were blurred by sheer distance, but there was something about its outlines that Alvin found puzzling. Then his eyes became at last accustomed to the scale of that colossal landscape, and he knew that those far-off walls had not been built by man. Time had not conquered everything. Earth still possessed mountains of which she could be proud. For a long time Alvin stood at the mouth of the tunnel, slowly growing accustomed to the strange world in which he had found himself. He was half stunned by the impact of sheer size and space. That ring of misty mountains could have enclosed a dozen cities as large as Diaspora. Search as he might, however, Alvin could see no trace of human life. Yet the road that led down the hillside seemed well kept. He could do no better than accept its guidance. At the foot of the hill, the road disappeared between great trees that almost hid the sun. As Alvin walked into their shadow, a strange medley of scents and sounds greeted him. The rustle of the wind among the leaves he had known before, but underlying that were a thousand vague noises that conveyed nothing to his mind. Unknown odors assailed him, smells that had been lost even to the memory of his race. The warmth, the profusion of scent and color, and the unseen presences of a million living things smote him with almost physical violence. He came upon the lake without any warning. The trees to the right suddenly ended, and before him was a great expanse of water, dotted with tiny islands. Never in his life had Alvin seen so much water. By comparison, the largest pools in Diaspora were scarcely more than puddles. He walked slowly down to the edge of the lake, and cupped the warm water in his hands, letting it trickle through his fingers. The great silver fish that suddenly forced its way through the underwater reeds was the first non-human creature that Alvin had ever seen. It should have been utterly strange to him, yet its shape teased his mind with a haunting familiarity. As it hung there in the pale green void, its fins a faint blur of motion, it seemed the very embodiment of power and speed. Here, incorporated in living flesh, were the graceful lines of the great ships that had once ruled the skies of Earth. Evolution and science had come to the same answers, and the work of nature had lasted longer. At last, Alvin broke the lake's enchantment and continued along the winding road. The forest closed around him once more, but only for a little while. Presently, the road ended in a great clearing half a mile wide and twice as long, and Alvin understood why he had seen no trace of man before. The clearing was full of low two-storied buildings, coloured in soft shades that rested the eye even in the full glare of the sun. Most were of clean, straightforward design, but several were built in a complex architectural style involving the use of fluted columns and gracefully fretted stone. In these buildings, which seemed of great age, the immeasurably ancient device of the pointed arch was used. As he walked slowly toward the village, Alvin was still struggling to grasp his new surroundings. Nothing was familiar. Even the air had changed, with its hint of throbbing unknown life, and the tall golden-haired people going among the buildings with such unconscious grace were obviously of a different stock from the men of Diaspora. They took no notice of Alvin, and that was strange, for his clothing was totally different from theirs. Since the temperature never changed in Diaspora, dress there was purely ornamental and often extremely elaborate. Here it seemed mainly functional, designed for use rather than display, and frequently consisted of a single sheet draped around the body. It was not until Alvin was well inside the village that the people of Lys reacted to his presence, and then their response took a somewhat unexpected form. A group of five men emerged from one of the houses and began to walk purposefully toward him, almost as if, indeed, they had been expecting his arrival. Alvin felt a sudden, heady excitement, and the blood pounded in his veins. He thought of all the fateful meetings men must have had with other races on far-off worlds. Those he was meeting now were of his own species, but how had they diverged in the eons that had sundered them from Diaspora? The delegation came to a halt a few feet away from Alvin. Its leader smiled, holding out his hand in the ancient gesture of friendship.
"We thought it best to meet you here," he said. "Our home is very different from Diaspora, and the walk from the terminus gives visitors a chance to become acclimatized."
Alvin accepted the outstretched hand, but for a moment was too surprised to reply. Now he understood why all the other villagers had ignored him so completely.
"You knew I was coming?" he said at length.
"Of course. We always know when the carriers start to move. Tell me, how did you discover the way? It has been such a long time since the last visit that we feared the secret had been lost."
The speaker was interrupted by one of his companions.
"I think we'd better restrain our curiosity, Geraint. Serranus is waiting."
The name Serranus was preceded by a word unfamiliar to Alvin, and he assumed that it was a title of some kind. He had no difficulty in understanding the others, and it never occurred to him that there was anything surprising about this. Diaspora and Lys shared the same linguistic heritage, and the ancient invention of sound recording had long ago frozen speech in an unbreakable mould. Geraint gave a shrug of mock resignation.
"Very well," he smiled. "Serranus has few privileges. I should not rob her of this one."
As they walked deeper into the village, Alvin studied the men around him. They appeared kindly and intelligent, but he was looking for ways in which they differed from a similar group in Diaspora. There were differences, but it was hard to define them. They were all somewhat taller than Alvin, and two of them showed the unmistakable marks of physical age. Their skins were very brown, and in all their movements, they seemed to radiate a vigor and zest which Alvin found refreshing, though at the same time a little bewildering. He smiled as he remembered Kedron's prophecy that, if he ever reached Lys, he would find it exactly the same as Diaspora. The people of the village now watched with frank curiosity as Alvin followed his guides. There was no longer any pretense that they took him for granted. Suddenly there were shrill, high-pitched shouts from the trees on the right, and a group of small, excited creatures burst out of the woods and crowded around Alvin. He stopped in utter amazement, unable to believe his eyes. Here was something that his world had lost so long ago that it lay in the realms of mythology. this was the way that life had once begun. These noisy, fascinating creatures were human children. Alvin watched them with wondering disbelief, and with another sensation which tugged at his heart, but which he could not yet identify. No other sight could have brought home to him so vividly his remoteness from the world he knew. Diaspora had paid, and paid in full, the price of immortality. The party halted before the largest building Alvin had yet seen. It stood in the center of the village, and from a flagpole on its small circular tower, a green pennant floated along the breeze. All but Geraint dropped behind as he entered the building. Inside, it was quiet and cool. Sunlight filtering through the translucent walls lit up everything with a soft, restful glow. The floor was smooth and resilient, inlaid with fine mosaics. On the walls, an artist of great ability and power had depicted a set of forest scenes. Mingled with these paintings were other murals which conveyed nothing to Alvin's mind, yet which were attractive and pleasant to look upon. Let into one wall was a rectangular screen filled with a shifting maze of colours. Presumably a visophone receiver, though a rather small one. They walked together up a short circular stairway that led them out onto the flat roof of the building. From this point, the entire village was visible, and Alvin could see that it consisted of about 100 buildings. In the distance, the trees opened out to enclose wide meadows, where animals of several different types were grazing. Alvin could not imagine what these were. Most of them were quadrupeds, but some seemed to have 6 or even 8 legs. Serranus was waiting for him in the shadow of the tower. Alvin wondered how old she was. Her long golden hair was touched with grey, which he guessed must be some indication of age. The presence of children, with all the consequences that implied, had left him very confused. Where there was birth, then surely there must also be death. And the lifespan here in Lys might be very different from that in Diaspora. He could not tell whether Serranus was 50, 500, or 5,000 years old, but looking into her eyes he could sense that wisdom and depth of experience he sometimes felt when he was with Jezerak. She pointed to a small seat, but though her eyes smiled a welcome, she said nothing until Alvin had made himself comfortable, or as comfortable as he could be under that intense though friendly scrutiny. Then she sighed, and addressed Alvin in a low, gentle voice. "This is an occasion which does not often arise, so you will excuse me if I do not know the correct behavior. But there are certain rites due to a guest, even if an unexpected one. Before we talk, there is something about which I should warn you. I can read your mind." She smiled at Alvin's obvious consternation and added quickly, "There is no need to let that worry you. No right is respected more strongly than that of mental privacy. I will enter your mind only if you invite me to. But it would not be fair to hide this fact from you, and it will explain why we find speech somewhat slow and difficult. It is not often used here." This revelation, though slightly alarming, did not surprise Alvin. Once both men and machines had possessed this power, and the unchanging machines could still read their master's orders. But in Diaspora, man himself had lost the gift he had once shared with his slaves. "I do not know what brought you from your world to ours," continued Serranus. "But if you are looking for life, your search has ended. Apart from Diaspora, there is only desert beyond our mountains." It was strange that Alvin, who had questioned accepted beliefs so often before, did not doubt the words of Serranus. His only reaction was one of sadness that all his teaching had been so nearly true. "Tell me about Lys," he begged. "Why have you been cut off from Diaspora for so long, when you seem to know so much about us?" Serranus smiled at his eagerness. "Presently," she said. "But first, I would like to know something about you. Tell me how you found the way here, and why you came." haltingly at first, and then with growing confidence, Alvin told his story. He had never spoken with such freedom before. Here, at last, was someone who would not laugh at his dreams because they knew those dreams were true. Once or twice, Serranus interrupted him with swift questions when he mentioned some aspect of Diaspora that was unfamiliar to her. It was hard for Alvin to realize that things which were part of his everyday life would be meaningless to someone who had never lived in the city and knew nothing of its complex culture and social organization. Serranus listened with such understanding that he took her comprehension for granted. Not until much later did he realize that many other minds besides hers were listening to his words. When he had finished, there was silence for a while. Then Serranus looked at him and said quietly, "Why did you come to Lys?" Alvin glanced at her in surprise. "I've told you," he said. "I wanted to explore the world. Everyone told me that there was only desert beyond the city, but I had to see for myself."
"And was that the only reason?"
Alvin hesitated. When at last he answered, it was not the indomitable explorer who spoke, but the lost child who had been born into an alien world.
"No," he said softly. "That wasn't the only reason, though I did not know it until now. I was lonely."
"Lonely? In Diaspora?" There was a smile on the lips of Serranus, but sympathy in her eyes, and Alvin knew that she expected no further answer. Now that he had told his story, he waited for her to keep her share of the bargain. Presently Serranus rose to her feet and began to pace to and fro on the roof.
"I know the questions you wish to ask," she said. "Some of them I can answer, but it would be wearisome to do it in words. If you will open your mind to me, I will tell you what you need to know. You can trust me. I will take nothing from you without your permission."
"What do you want me to do?"
said Alvin cautiously.
"Will yourself to accept my help. Look at my eyes and forget everything," commanded Serranus.
Alvin was never sure what happened then. There was a total eclipse of all his senses, and though he could never remember acquiring it, when he looked into his mind, the knowledge was there. He saw back into the past, not clearly, but as a man on some high mountain might look out across a misty plain. He understood that man had not always been a city dweller, and that since the machines gave him freedom from toil, there had always been a rivalry between two different types of civilization. In the dawn of ages, there had been thousands of cities, but a large part of mankind had preferred to live in relatively small communities. Universal transport and instantaneous communication had given them all the contact they required with the rest of the world, and they felt no need to live huddled together with millions of their fellows. Lys had been little different in the early days from hundreds of other communities, but gradually over the ages it developed an independent culture, which was one of the highest that mankind had ever known. It was a culture based largely upon the direct use of mental power, and this set it apart from the rest of human society, which came to rely more and more upon machines. Through the eons, as they advanced along their different roads, the gulf between Lys and the cities widened. It was bridged only in times of great crisis. When the moon was falling, its destruction was carried out by the scientists of Lys. So also was the defense of Earth against the invaders, who were held at bay in the final battle of Shalmarain. That great ordeal exhausted mankind. One by one, the cities died and the desert rolled over them. As the population fell, humanity began the migration that was to make Diaspora the last and greatest of all cities. Most of these changes did not affect Lys, but it had its own battle to fight, the battle against the desert. The natural barrier of the mountains was not enough, and many ages passed before the great oasis was made secure. The picture was blurred here, perhaps deliberately. Alvin could not see what had been done to give Lys the virtual eternity that Diaspora had achieved. The voice of Serranus seemed to come to him from a great distance, yet it was not her voice alone, for it was merged into a symphony of words as though many other tongues were chanting in unison with hers. That, very briefly, is our history. You will see that even in the Dawn Ages, we had little to do with the cities, though their people often came into our land. We never hindered them, for many of our greatest men came from outside. But when the cities were dying, we did not wish to be involved in their downfall. With the ending of air transport, there was only one way into Lys, the carrier system from Diaspora. It was closed at your end when the park was built and you forgot us, though we have never forgotten you. Diaspora has surprised us. We expected it to go the way of all other cities, but instead it has achieved a stable culture that may last as long as Earth. It is not a culture that we admire, yet we are glad that those who wish to escape have been able to do so. More than you might think have made the journey, and they have almost always been outstanding men who brought something of value with them when they came to Lys. The voice faded. The paralysis of Alvin's senses ebbed away and he was himself again. He saw with astonishment that the sun had fallen far below the trees and that the eastern sky already held a hint of night. Somewhere a great bell vibrated with a throbbing boom that pulsed slowly into silence, leaving the air tense with mystery and premonition. Alvin found himself trembling slightly, not with the first touch of the evening's chill, but through sheer awe and wonder at all that he had learned. It was very late, and he was far from home. He had a sudden need to see his friends again, and to be among the familiar sights and scenes of Diaspora. "I must return," he said. "Kedron, my parents, they will be expecting me." That was not wholly true. Kedron would certainly be wondering what had happened to him, but as far as Alvin was aware, no one else knew that he had left Diaspora. He could not have explained the reason for this mild deceit, and was slightly ashamed of himself as soon as he had uttered the words. Serranus looked at him thoughtfully. "I am afraid it is not as easy as that," she said. "What do you mean?" asked Alvin. "Won't the carrier that brought me here take me back again?" He still refused to face the idea that he might be held in this against his will, though the idea had briefly crossed his mind. For the first time, Serranus seemed slightly ill at ease. "We have been talking about you," she said, not explaining who the we might be, nor exactly how they had consulted together. "If you return to Diaspora, the whole city will know about us. Even if you promise to say nothing, you would find it impossible to keep our secret."
"Why should you wish it kept?" asked Alvin.
"Surely it would be a good thing for both our peoples if they could meet again." Serranus looked displeased. "We do not think so," she said. "If the gates were opened, our land would be flooded with the idly curious and the sensation seekers. As it is now, only the best of your people have ever reached us." This reply radiated so much unconscious superiority, yet was based on such false assumptions, that Alvin felt his annoyance quite eclipse his alarm.
"That isn't true," he said flatly. "I do not believe you would find another person in Diaspora who could leave the city even if he wanted to, even if he knew that there was somewhere to go. If you let me return, it would make no difference to Lys."
"It is not my decision," explained Serranus. "And you underestimate the powers of the mind if you think that the barriers that keep your people inside their city can never be broken. However, we do not wish to hold you here against your will. But if you return to Diaspora, we must erase all memories of Lys from your mind." She hesitated for a moment. "This has never risen before. All your predecessors came here to stay." Here was a choice that Alvin refused to accept. He wanted to explore Lys, to learn all its secrets, to discover the ways in which they differed from his own home. But equally, he was determined to return to Diaspora, so that he could prove to his friends that he had been no idle dreamer. He could not understand the reasons prompting this desire for secrecy. Even if he had, it would not have made any difference in his behavior. He realized that he must play for time, or else convince Sir Annis that what she asked him was impossible. "Kedron knows where I am," he said. "You cannot erase his memories." Sir Annis smiled. It was a pleasant smile, and one that in any other circumstances would have been friendly enough. But behind it Elvin glimpsed, for the first time, the presence of overwhelming and implacable power. "You underestimate us, Alvin," she replied. "That would be very easy. I can reach Diaspora more quickly than I can cross Lys. Other men have come here before, and some of them told their friends where they were going. Yet those friends forget them, and they vanished from the history of Diaspora." Alvin had been foolish to ignore this possibility, though it was obvious now that Sir Annis had pointed it out. He wondered how many times in the millions of years since the two cultures were separated, men from Lys had gone into Diaspora in order to preserve their jealously guarded secret. And he wondered just how extensive were the mental powers which these strange people possessed and did not hesitate to use. Was it safe to make any plans at all? Sir Annis had promised that she would not read his mind without his consent, but he wondered if there might be circumstances in which that promise would not be kept. "Surely," he said, "you don't expect me to make the decision at once. Cannot I see something of your country before I make my choice?" "Of course," replied Sir Annis. "You can stay here as long as you wish, and still return to Diaspora eventually if you change your mind. But if you can decide within the next few days, it will be very much easier. You do not want your friends to be worried, and the longer you are missing, the harder it will be for us to make the necessary adjustments." Alvin could appreciate that. He would like to know just what those adjustments were. Presumably someone from Lys would contact Kedron, without the jester ever being aware of it, and tamper with his mind. The fact of Alvin's disappearance could not be concealed, but the information that he and Kedron had discovered could be obliterated. As the ages passed, Alvin's name would join those of the other uniques who had mysteriously vanished without trace and had then been forgotten. There were many mysteries here, and he seemed no closer to solving any of them. Was there any purpose behind the curious one-sided relationship between Lys and Diaspora, or was it merely a historical accident? Who and what were the uniques, and if the people from Lys could enter Diaspora, why had they not cancelled the memory circuits that held the clue to their existence? Perhaps that was the only question to which Alvin could give a plausible answer. The central computer might be too stubborn an opponent to tackle, and would hardly be affected by even the most advanced of mental techniques. He put these problems aside. One day, when he had learned a great deal more, he might have some chance of answering them. It was idle to speculate, to build pyramids of surmise on a foundation of ignorance. "Very well," he said, though not too graciously, for he was still annoyed that this unexpected obstacle had been placed in his path. "I'll give you my answer as soon as I can, if you will show me what your land is like." "Good," said Sir Annis, and this time her smile held no hidden threat. "We are proud of Lys, and it will be a pleasure to show you how men can live without the aid of cities. Meanwhile, there is no need for you to worry. Your friends will not be alarmed by your absence. We shall see to that, if only for our own protection." It was the first time Sir Annis had ever made a promise that she could not keep. Chapter 11. Try as she would, Alistra could extract no further information from Kedron. The jester had recovered quickly from his initial shock, and from the panic that had sent him flying back to the surface when he found himself alone in the depths beneath the tomb. He also felt ashamed of his cowardly behavior, and wondered if he would ever have the courage to return to the Chamber of the Moving Ways and the network of world-ranging tunnels that radiated from it. Although he felt that Alvin had been impatient, if not indeed foolhardy, he did not really believe that he would run into any danger. He would return in his own good time. Kedron was certain of that. Well, almost certain. There was just enough doubt to make him feel the need for caution. It would be wise, he decided, to say as little as possible for the time being, and to pass the whole thing off as another joke. Unfortunately for this plan, he had not been able to mask his emotions when Alistair encountered him on his return to the surface. She had seen the fear written so unmistakably in his eyes, and had at once interpreted it as meaning that Alvin was in danger. All Kedron's reassurances were in vain, and she became more and more angry with him as they walked together back through the park. At first, Alistair had wanted to remain at the tomb, waiting for Alvin to return in whatever mysterious manner he had vanished. Kedron had managed to convince her that this would be a waste of time, and was relieved when she followed him back to the city. There was a chance that Alvin might return almost at once, and he did not wish anyone else to discover the secret of Jarl and Zay. By the time they had reached the city, it was obvious to Kedron that his evasive tactics had failed completely, and that the situation was seriously out of hand. It was the first time in his life that he had ever been at a loss and had not felt himself capable of dealing with any problem that arose. His immediate and irrational fear was being slowly replaced by a profounder and more firmly based alarm. Until now, Kedron had given little thought to the consequences of his actions. His own interests and a mild but genuine empathy toward Alvin had been sufficient motive for all that he had done. Though he had given encouragement and assistance to Alvin, he had never believed that anything like this could ever really happen. Despite the gulf of years and experience between them, Alvin's will had always been more powerful than his own. It was too late to do anything about it now. Kedron felt that events were sweeping him along toward a climax utterly beyond his control. In view of this, it was a little unfair that Alistair obviously regarded him as Alvin's evil genius and showed an inclination to blame him for all that had happened. Alistair was not really vindictive, but she was annoyed, and part of her annoyance focused on Kedron. If any action of hers caused him trouble, she would be the last person to be sorry. They parted in stony silence when they had reached the great circular way that surrounded the park. Kedron watched Alistair disappear into the distance and wondered wearily what plans were brewing in her mind. There was only one thing of which he could be certain now. Boredom would not be a serious problem for a considerable time to come. Alistair acted swiftly and with intelligence. She did not bother to contact Ariston or Atania. Alvin's parents were pleasant non-entities for whom she felt some affection but no respect. They would only waste time in futile arguments and would then do exactly as Alistair was doing now. Jezerak listened to her story without apparent emotion. If he was alarmed or surprised, he concealed it well. So well that Alistair was somewhat disappointed. It seemed to her that nothing so extraordinary and important as this had ever happened before, and Jezerak's matter-of-fact behavior made her feel deflated. When she had finished, he questioned her at some length, and hinted, without actually saying so, that she might have made a mistake. What reason was there for supposing that Alvin had really left the city? Perhaps it had been a trick at her expense. The fact that Kedron was involved made this seem highly probable. Alvin might be laughing at her, concealed somewhere in Diaspora at this very moment. The only positive reaction she got out of Jezerak was a promise to make inquiries and to contact her again within a day. In the meantime, she was not to worry, and it would also be best if she said nothing to anyone else about the whole affair. There was no need to spread alarm over an incident that would probably be cleared up in a few hours. Alistair left Jezerak in a mood of mild frustration. She would have been more satisfied could she have seen his behavior immediately after she had left. Jezerak had friends on the council. He had been a member himself in his long life, and might be again if he was unlucky. He called three of his most influential colleagues and cautiously aroused their interest. As Alvin's tutor, he was well aware of his own delicate position and was anxious to safeguard himself. For the present, the fewer who knew what had happened, the better. It was immediately agreed that the first thing to do was to contact Kedron and ask him for an explanation. There was only one defect in the excellent plan. Kedron had anticipated it, and was nowhere to be found. If there was any ambiguity about Alvin's position, his hosts were very careful not to remind him of it. He was free to go anywhere he wished in Airlie, the little village over which Serranus ruled. Though that was too strong a word to describe her position. Sometimes it seemed to Alvin that she was a benevolent dictator, but at other times it appeared that she had no powers at all. So far he had failed completely to understand the social system of Lys, either because it was too simple, or else so complex that its ramifications eluded him. All he had discovered for certain was that Lys was divided into innumerable villages, of which Airlie was a quite typical example. Yet in a sense, there were no typical examples, for Alvin had been assured that every village tried to be as unlike its neighbours as possible. It was all extremely confusing. Though it was very small and contained less than 1,000 people, Airlie was full of surprises. There was hardly a single aspect of life that did not differ from its counterpart in Diaspora. The differences extended even to such fundamentals as speech. Only the children used their voices for normal communication. The adults scarcely ever spoke, and after a while, Alvin decided that they did so only out of politeness to him. It was a curiously frustrating experience to feel oneself enmeshed in a great net of soundless and undetectable words. But after a while, Alvin grew accustomed to it. It seemed surprising that vocal speech had survived at all, since there was no longer any use for it. But Alvin later discovered that the people of Lys were very fond of singing, and indeed of all forms of music. Without this incentive, it was very likely that they would long ago have become completely mute. They were always busy, engaged in tasks or problems which were usually incomprehensible to Alvin. When he could understand what they were doing, much of their work seemed quite unnecessary. A considerable part of their food, for example, was actually grown and not synthesized in accordance with patterns worked out ages ago. When Alvin commented on this, it was patiently explained to him that the people of Lys liked to watch things grow, to carry out complicated genetic experiments, and to evolve ever more subtle tastes and flavors. Airlie was famous for its fruits, but when Alvin ate some choice samples, they seemed to him no better than those he could have conjured up in Diaspora by no more effort than raising a finger. At first, he wondered if the people of Lys had forgotten, or had never possessed, the powers and machines that he took for granted, and upon which all life in Diaspora was based. He soon found that this was not the case. The tools and the knowledge were there, but they were used only when it was essential. The most striking example of this was provided by the transport system, if it could be dignified by such a name. For short distances, people walked and seemed to enjoy it. If they were in a hurry or had small loads to move, they used animals which had obviously been developed for the purpose. The freight-carrying species was a low six-legged beast, very docile and strong, but of poor intelligence. The racing animals were of a different breed altogether, normally walking on four legs, but using only their heavily muscled hind limbs when they really got up speed. They could cross the entire width of Lys in a few hours, and the passenger rode in a pivoted seat, strapped on the creature's back. Nothing in the world would have induced Alvin to risk such a ride, though it was a very popular sport among the younger men. Their finely bred steeds were the aristocrats of the animal world, and were well aware of it. They had fairly large vocabularies, and Alvin often overheard them talking boastfully among themselves about past and future victories. When he tried to be friendly and attempted to join in the conversation, they pretended that they could not understand him, and if he persisted, would go bounding off in outraged dignity. These two varieties of animal sufficed for all ordinary needs, and gave their owners a great deal of pleasure which no mechanical contrivances could have done. But when extreme speed was required or vast loads had to be moved, the machines were there and were used without hesitation. Though the animal life of Lys presented Alvin with a whole world of new interests and surprises, it was the two extremes of the human population range that fascinated him most of all. The very young and the very old. Both were equally strange to him and equally amazing. Airlie's most senior inhabitant had barely attained his second century and had only a few more years of life before him. When he had reached that age, Alvin reminded himself, his body would scarcely have altered, whereas this old man, who had no chain of future existences to look forward to as compensation, had almost exhausted his physical powers. His hair was completely white, and his face an unbelievably intricate mass of wrinkles. He seemed to spend most of his time sitting in the sun or walking slowly around the village, exchanging soundless greetings with everyone he met. As far as Alvin could tell, he was completely contented, asking no more of life and was not distressed by its approaching end. Here was a philosophy so much at variance with that of Diaspora as to be completely beyond Alvin's comprehension. Why should anyone accept death when it was so unnecessary, when you had the choice of living for 1,000 years and then leaping forward through the millenniums to make a new start in a world that you had helped to shape? This was one mystery he was determined to solve as soon as he had the chance of discussing it frankly. It was very hard for him to believe that Lys had made this choice of its own free will if it knew the alternative that existed. He found part of his answer among the children, those little creatures who were as strange to him as any of the animals of Lys. He spent much of his time among them, watching them at their play, and eventually being accepted by them as a friend. Sometimes it seemed to him that they were not human at all. Their motives, their logic, and even their language were so alien. He would look unbelievingly at the adults and ask himself how it was possible that they could have evolved from these extraordinary creatures who seemed to spend most of their lives in a private world of their own. And yet, even while they baffled him, they aroused within his heart a feeling he had never known before. When, which was not often but sometimes happened, they burst into tears of utter frustration or despair, their tiny disappointments seemed to him more tragic than man's long retreat after the loss of his galactic empire. That was something too huge and remote for comprehension, but the weeping of a child could pierce one to the heart. Alvin had met love in Diaspora, but now he was learning something equally precious, and without which love itself could never reach its highest fulfillment, but must remain forever incomplete. He was learning tenderness. If Alvin was studying Lys, Lys was also studying him, and was not dissatisfied with what it had found. He had been in Airlie for 3 days when Serranus suggested that he might like to go further afield and see something more of her country. It was a proposal he accepted at once, on condition that he was not expected to ride one of the village's prize racing beasts. "I can assure you," said Serranus with a rare flash of humour, "that no one here would dream of risking one of their precious animals. Since this is an exceptional case, I will arrange transport in which you will feel more at home. Hilvar will act as your guide, but of course you can go wherever you please." Alvin wondered if that was strictly true. He imagined that there would be some objection if he tried to return to the little hill from whose summit he had first emerged into Lys. However, that did not worry him for the moment, since he was in no hurry to go back to Diaspora, and indeed had given little thought to the problem after his initial meeting with Serranus. Life here was still so interesting and so novel that he was still quite content to live in the present. He appreciated Serranus's gesture in offering her son as his guide, though doubtless Hilvar had been given careful instructions to see that he did not get into mischief. It had taken Alvin some time to get accustomed to Hilvar, for a reason which he could not very well explain to him without hurting his feelings. Physical perfection was so universal in Diaspora that personal beauty had been completely devalued. Men noticed it no more than the air they breathed. This was not the case in Lys, and the most flattering adjective that could be applied to Hilvar was homely. By Alvin's standards, he was downright ugly, and for a while he had deliberately avoided him. If Hilvar was aware of this, he showed no sign of it, and it was not long before his good-natured friendliness had broken through the barrier between them. The time was to come when Alvin would be so accustomed to Hilvar's broad, twisted smile, his strength, and his gentleness, that he could scarcely believe he had ever found him unattractive, and would not have had him changed for any consideration in the world. They left early soon after dawn in a small vehicle, which Hilvar called a ground car, and which apparently worked on the same principle as the machine that had brought Alvin from Diaspora. It floated in the air a few inches above the turf, and although there was no sign of any guide rail, Hilvar told him that the cars could run only on predetermined routes. All the centres of population were linked together in this fashion, but during his entire stay in Lys, Alvin never saw another ground car in use. Hilvar had put a great deal of effort into organising this expedition, and was obviously looking forward to it quite as much as Alvin. He had planned the route with his own interests in mind, for natural history was his consuming passion, and he hoped to find new types of insect life in the relatively uninhabited regions of Lys which they would be visiting. He intended to travel as far south as the machine could take them, and the rest of the way they would have to go on foot. Not realizing the full implications of this, Alvin made no objections. They had a companion with them on the journey, Criff, the most spectacular of Hilvar's many pets. When Criff was resting, his six gauzy wings lay folded along his body, which glittered through them like a jeweled scepter. If something disturbed him, he would rise into the air with a flicker of iridescence and a faint whirring of invisible wings. Though the great insect would come when called and would sometimes obey simple orders, it was almost wholly mindless. Yet it had a definite personality of its own, and for some reason was suspicious of Alvin, whose sporadic attempts to gain its confidence always ended in failure. To Alvin, the journey across Lys had a dreamlike unreality. Silent as a ghost, the machine slid across rolling plains and wound its way through forests, never deviating from its invisible track. It travelled perhaps 10 times as fast as a man could comfortably walk. Seldom indeed was any inhabitant of Lys in a greater hurry than that. They passed through many villages, some larger than Airlie, but most of them built along very similar lines. Alvin was interested to notice the subtle but significant differences in clothing and even physical appearance that occurred as they moved from one community to the next. The civilization of Lys was composed of hundreds of distinct cultures, each contributing some special talent toward the whole. The ground car was well stocked with Airlie's most famous product, a small yellow peach, which was gratefully received whenever Hilvar gave away some samples. He often stopped to talk to friends and to introduce Alvin, who never ceased to be impressed by the simple courtesy with which everyone used vocal speech as soon as they knew who he was. It must often have been very tedious to them, but as far as he could judge, they always resisted the temptation to lapse into telepathy, and he never felt excluded from their conversation. They made their longest pause at a tiny village almost hidden in a sea of tall golden grass, which soared high above their heads, and which undulated in the gentle wind as if it was endowed with life. As they moved through it, they were continually overtaken by rolling waves as the countless blades bowed in unison above them. At first it was faintly disturbing, for Alvin had a foolish fancy that the grass was bending down to look at him, but after a while he found the continual motion quite restful. Alvin soon discovered why they had made this stop. Among the little crowd that had already gathered before the car came gliding into the village was a shy, dark girl, whom Hilvar introduced as Nyara. They were obviously very pleased to see one another again, and Alvin felt envious of their patent happiness at this brief reunion. Hilvar was clearly torn between his duties as a guide and his desire to have no other company but Nyara, and Alvin soon rescued him from his quandary by setting off on a tour of exploration by himself. There was not much to see in the little village, but he took his time. When they started on their way again, there were many questions he was anxious to ask Hilvar. He could not imagine what love must be like in a telepathic society. And after a discreet interval, he broached the subject. Hilvar was willing enough to explain, even though Alvin suspected that he had made his friend interrupt a prolonged and tender mental leave-taking. In this, it seemed, all love began with mental contact, and it might be months or years before a couple actually met. In this way, Hilvar explained, there could be no false impressions, no deceptions on either side. Two people whose minds were open to one another could hide no secrets. If either attempted it, the other partner would know at once that something was being concealed. Only very mature and well-balanced minds could afford such honesty. Only love based upon absolute unselfishness could survive it. Alvin could well understand that such a love would be deeper and richer than anything his people could know. It could be so perfect, in fact, that he found it hard to believe that it could ever occur at all. Yet Hilvar assured him that it did, and became starry-eyed and lost in his own reveries when Alvin pressed him to be more explicit. There were some things that could not be communicated. One either knew them, or one did not. Alvin decided sadly that he could never attain the kind of mutual understanding which these fortunate people had made the very basis of their lives. When the ground car emerged from the savannah, which ended abruptly as though a frontier had been drawn beyond which the grass was not permitted to grow, there was a range of low, heavily wooded hills ahead of them. This was an outpost, Hilvar explained, of the main rampart guarding this. The real mountains lay beyond, but to Alvin, even these small hills were an impressive and awe-inspiring sight. The car came to a halt in a narrow, sheltered valley, which was still flooded by the warmth and light of the descending sun. Hilvar looked at Alvin with a kind of wide-eyed candor which, one could have sworn, was totally innocent of any guile. "This is where we start to walk," he said cheerfully, beginning to throw equipment out of the vehicle. "We can't ride any farther." Alvin looked at the hills surrounding them, then at the comfortable seat in which he had been riding. "Isn't there a way around?" he asked, not very hopefully. "Of course," replied Hilvar. "But we're not going around. We're going to the top, which is much more interesting. I'll put the car on automatic, so that it will be waiting for us when we get down the other side." Determined not to give in without a struggle, Alvin made one last effort. "It will soon be dark," he protested. "We'll never be able to go all that way before sunset."
"Exactly,"
said Hilvar, sorting packages and equipment with incredible speed.
"We'll spend the night on the summit and finish the journey in the morning."
For once, Alvin knew when he was beaten. The gear that they were carrying looked very formidable, but though it was bulky, it weighed practically nothing. It was all packed in gravity-polarizing containers that neutralized its weight, leaving only inertia to be contended with. As long as Alvin moved in a straight line, he was not conscious that he was carrying any load. Dealing with these containers required a little practice, for if he attempted to make a sudden change of direction, his pack seemed to develop a stubborn personality and did its best to keep him on his original course, until he had overcome its momentum. When Hilvar had adjusted all the straps and satisfied himself that everything was in order, they began to walk slowly up the valley. Alvin looked back wistfully as the ground car retraced its track and disappeared from sight. He wondered how many hours would elapse before he could again relax in its comfort. Nevertheless, it was very pleasant climbing upward with the mild sun beating on their backs and seeing ever new vistas unfold around them. There was a partly obliterated path which disappeared from time to time, but which Hilvar seemed able to follow even when Alvin could see no trace of it. He asked Hilvar what had made the path, and was told that there were many small animals in these hills, some solitary, and some living in primitive communities, which echoed many of the features of human civilization. A few had even discovered, or been taught, the use of tools and fire. It never occurred to Alvin that such creatures might be other than friendly. Both he and Hilvar took this for granted, for it had been so many ages since anything on earth had challenged the supremacy of man. They had been climbing for half an hour when Alvin first noticed the faint reverberating murmur in the air around him. He could not detect its source, for it seemed to come from no particular direction. It never ceased, and it grew steadily louder as the landscape widened around them. He would have asked Hilvar what it was, but it had become necessary to save his breath for more essential purposes. Alvin was in perfect health. Indeed, he had never had an hour's illness in his life. But physical well-being, however important and necessary it might be, was not sufficient for the task he was facing now. He had the body, but he did not possess the skill. Hilvar's easy strides, the effortless surge of power which took him up every slope, filled Alvin with envy and a determination not to give in while he could still place one foot in front of the other. He knew perfectly well that Hilvar was testing him and did not resent the fact. It was a good-natured game, and he entered into the spirit of it even while the fatigue spread slowly through his legs. Hilvar took pity on him when they had completed two-thirds of the ascent, and they rested for a while, propped up against a westward-facing bank, letting the mellow sunlight drench their bodies. The throbbing thunder was very strong now, and although Alvin questioned him, Hilvar refused to explain it. It would, he said, spoil the surprise if Alvin knew what to expect at the end of the climb. They were now racing against the sun, but fortunately the final ascent was smooth and gentle. The trees that had covered the lower part of the hill had now thinned out, as if they too were tired of the fight against gravity, and for the last few hundred yards, the ground was carpeted with short, wiry grass on which it was very pleasant to walk. As the summit came in sight, Hilvar put forth a sudden burst of energy and went racing up the slope. Alvin decided to ignore the challenge. Indeed, he had no choice. He was quite content to plod steadily onward, and when he had caught up with Hilvar, to collapse in contented exhaustion by his side. Not until he had regained his breath was he able to appreciate the view spread out beneath him, and to see the origin of the endless thunder which now filled the air. The ground ahead fell away steeply from the crest of the hill, so steeply, indeed, that it soon became an almost vertical cliff. And leaping far out from the face of the cliff was a mighty ribbon of water, which curved out through space to crash into the rocks 1,000 feet below. There it was lost in a shimmering mist of spray, while up from the depths rose that ceaseless drumming thunder that reverberated in hollow echoes from the hills on either side. Most of the waterfall was now in shadow, but the sunlight streaming past the mountain still illuminated the land beneath, adding the final touch of magic to the scene. For quivering in evanescent beauty above the base of the fall was the last rainbow left on earth. Hilvar waved his arm in a sweep which embraced the whole horizon. "From here," he said, raising his voice so that it could be heard above the thunder of the waterfall, "you can see right across Lys." Alvin could well believe him. To the north lay mile upon mile of forest, broken here and there by clearings and fields and the wandering threads of 100 rivers. Hidden somewhere in that vast panorama was the village of Airlie, but it was hopeless to try to find it. Alvin fancied that he could catch a glimpse of the lake past which the path led to the entrance into Lys, but decided that his eyes had tricked him. Still farther north, trees and clearings alike were lost in a mottled carpet of green, rucked here and there by lines of hills. And beyond that, at the very edge of vision, the mountains that hemmed Lys from the desert lay like a bank of distant clouds. East and west, the view was little different, but to the south, the mountains seemed only a few miles away. Alvin could see them very clearly, and he realized that they were far higher than the little peak on which he was standing. They were separated from him by country that was much wilder than the land through which he had just passed. In some indefinable way, it seemed deserted and empty, as if man had not lived here for many, many years. Hilvar answered Alvin's unspoken question. "Once that part of Lys was inhabited," he said. "I don't know why it was abandoned, and perhaps one day we shall move into it again. Only the animals live there now." Indeed, there was nowhere any sign of human life, none of the clearings or well-disciplined rivers that spoke of man's presence. Only in one spot was there any indication that he had ever lived here. For many miles away, a solitary white ruin jutted above the forest roof like a broken fang. Elsewhere, the jungle had returned to its own. The sun was sinking below the western walls of Lys. For a breathless moment, the distant mountains seemed to burn with golden flames. Then the land they guarded was swiftly drowned with shadow, and the night had come.
"We should have done this before," said Hilvar, practical as ever, as he started to unload their equipment. "It'll be pitch dark in 5 minutes, and cold, too."
Curious pieces of apparatus began to cover the grass. A slim tripod extended a vertical rod, carrying a pear-shaped bulge at its upper end. Hilvar raised this until the pear was just clear of their heads, and gave some mental signal which Alvin could not intercept. At once, their little encampment was flooded with light, and the darkness retreated. The pear gave not only light, but also heat, for Alvin could feel a gentle, caressing glow that seemed to sink into his very bones. Carrying the tripod in one hand and his pack in the other, Hilvar walked down the slope, while Alvin hurried behind, doing his best to keep in the circle of light. He finally pitched camp in a small depression a few hundred yards below the crest of the hill, and started to put the rest of his equipment into operation. First came a large hemisphere of some rigid and almost invisible material, which englobed them completely and protected them from the cool breeze which had now begun to blow up the face of the hill. The dome appeared to be generated by a small rectangular box, which Hilvar placed on the ground and then ignored completely, even to the extent of burying it beneath the rest of his paraphernalia. Perhaps this also projected the comfortable, semi-transparent couches on which Alvin was so glad to relax. It was the first time he had seen furniture materialized in Lys, where it seemed to him that the houses were terribly cluttered up with permanent artifacts, which would be much better kept safely out of the way in memory banks. The meal which Hilvar produced from yet another of his receptacles was also the first purely synthetic one that Alvin had eaten since reaching Lys. There was a steady blast of air sucked through some orifice in the dome overhead, as the matter converter seized its raw material and performed its everyday miracle. On the whole, Alvin was much happier with purely synthetic food. The way in which the other kind was prepared struck him as being appallingly unhygienic, and at least with the matter converters you knew exactly what you were eating. They settled down for their evening meal as the night deepened around them and the stars came out. When they had finished, it was completely dark beyond their circle of light, and at the edge of that circle, Alvin could see dim shapes moving as the creatures of the forest crept out of their hiding places. From time to time he caught the glint of reflected light as pale eyes stared back at him, but whatever beasts were watching out there would come no closer, so he could see nothing more of them. It was very peaceful, and Alvin felt utterly content. For a while they lay on their couches and talked about the things that they had seen, the mystery that enmeshed them both, and the many ways in which their two cultures differed. Hilvar was fascinated by the miracle of the eternity circuits, which had put Diaspora beyond the reach of time, and Alvin found some of his questions very hard to answer.
"What I don't understand," said Hilvar, "is how the designers of Diaspora made certain that nothing would ever go wrong with the memory circuits. You tell me that the information defining the city and all the people who live in it is stored as patterns of electric charge inside crystals. Well, crystals will last forever, but what about all the circuits associated with them? Aren't there ever any failures of any kind?"
I asked Kedron that same question, and he told me that the memory banks are virtually triplicated. Any one of the three banks can maintain the city, and if anything goes wrong with one of them, the other two automatically correct it. Only if the same failure occurred simultaneously in two of the banks would any permanent damage be done, and the chances of that are infinitesimal.
And how is the relation maintained between the patterns stored in the memory units and the actual structure of the city? Between the plan, as it were,
and the thing it describes.
Alvin was now completely out of his depth.